The life of a wild animal is nasty, brutish, and short. Without the benefit of modern medicine, illness and death are never far away. But the picture isn't all bleak. Many animals can turn to a powerful array of weapons to stave off infection and disease. It's this that's led to the tantalising prospect that some animals might have medical secrets that could be useful for us, either in their behaviour or in their innate biology. As microbes become resistant to traditional antibiotics like penicillin, the hunt is on for new drugs. Pharmaceutical companies have long plundered the rainforests for plants, but should they also be looking at what the animals do?
The chimpanzees in the field feed on it in a very peculiar way. So we postulated that possibly the animals were self-medicating with it.
Not a pristine environment, and yet these wounds heal magically, if you will, and there's no redness, there was no inflammation, there was no pus.
A few years ago, a couple of pigs came in for routine castration and other procedures, and we noticed that they had these malignant melanomas. And the interesting thing was that they seemed to be in regression. I'm sure nobody knows that there's some kind of miracle has occurred with these pigs.
Skin cancer is a growing problem for humans. Ultraviolet light seems to weaken our immune systems, and we're getting more and more exposure to it as the ozone layer becomes depleted and we take more holidays in sunny places. Something like 1 in 75 people in America now get skin cancer, so-called malignant melanomas. Among animals, Vietnamese pot-bellied pigs are also prone to skin cancer, but they seem to have an amazing ability to shrug off the illness, as Professor David Lloyd and Rosario Chorandolo of the Royal Veterinary College discovered. They investigated 10 pigs owned by members of the British Vietnamese Pot-bellied Pig Club, among them Myrtle, Tiggy, Oscar, Roger, Freddy, Winnie and Niglet.
Vietnamese pot-bellied pigs are very cute little pigs. They have pot bellies and they have a very sort of squashed up snout, and they look very interesting and they're cute. They grow, of course, to be quite big, and that can be a problem. They have black skin, and these tumours appear in quite young pigs as little circular or oval, slightly crusty raised areas, and then these just grow bigger. And we subsequently discovered that pigs are quite good at actually recovering from malignant melanoma. Most of the work was actually done by Dr. Chorandolo, but we developed a very interesting project, which I think has had some results which possibly show ways in which the pig can help man in terms of learning how to deal with these tumours.
The owners who are keeping these things, they're not farmers either, they're hobbyists, they're enthusiasts, they're kept as pets.
Yes.
Have Vietnamese pot-bellied pig owners been aware that their pets have been particularly prone to getting skin cancer?
Some owners have actually noticed these things and actually were much more aware of them than we knew. In fact, the Vietnamese Pot-bellied Pig Club has been hugely helpful in identifying for us numbers of pigs that are affected. But of course, some people are just keeping their pigs, you know, in a more casual sort of way. They think, well, pigs get scratches, it's just a scratch, or it had a little lump on it. After all, if you graze yourself and get a little wound, you don't go thinking about it every day. And it's only when these things get big, or many of them appear, that veterinary surgeons get asked about them.
If a human got a melanoma as big as the ones you're describing, say 4 centimetres across, the outlook would be pretty bad, wouldn't it?
Yes. If it was a malignant one, and many of them are malignant, the prognosis is grave. In fact, as soon as they start spreading, routine treatment really is palliative. In other words, you're trying to keep the person comfortable. You really don't expect to be able to cure them.
But what happens with the pigs, by contrast?
Well, the pigs get to a certain stage where they've got perhaps quite a lot of these tumours, and then suddenly they stop growing, and you begin to see them regressing, getting smaller and smaller, and at the end of it you never know that they've ever had a tumour.
So there are lots of pigs out there which are recovered cancer victims, and nobody even knows that the pig has been through this awful process and come out the other side.
I'm sure nobody knows that there's some kind of miracle has occurred with these pigs. No, it's true.
So, what are the mechanisms involved in the miracle? Professor Lloyd's colleague, Dr. Rosario Cherandolo, discovered that the pig's immune system is apparently unique among animals in its ability to recognize and destroy the cancerous cells.
The immune system of the pig is probably something unusual, different from the immune system of other animals, because it does not occur in other species like dogs and cats or horses, for example. So it's something that we need to study further to find out exactly how powerful is the immune system in pigs and why it's able to fight the cancer.
And the immune system does this by what?
By producing cells that are able to attack, to fight the melanoma cells, and also antibodies bind to the cells and are able to destroy the cells.
Because if one's immune system could fight off cancer, then life would be...
Or could be the key for the treatment of this disease.
So far, the work hasn't progressed beyond confirming that these pigs do recover from skin cancer and that it's their immune systems that are responsible. Human immune systems aren't nearly as good at recognizing malignant melanoma cells or at producing antibodies to fight them. The next stage for medical researchers would be to find ways to boost our immune systems to improve the performance to pig level. And there are other animal immune systems that have clever tricks we might learn from. Frogs are able to cure themselves of infection, as Michael Zasloff discovered 15 years ago, when laboratory specimens he fully expected to die after surgery staged an astonishing comeback. He'd more or less abandoned them to their fate in a squalid corner of his laboratory.
They're in a tank. The tank is not sterile. The animals are defecating in the tank. There's food fermenting. It's not a pristine environment, and yet these wounds heal magically, if you will. There's no redness, there was no inflammation, there was no pus, there was nothing, and that is the manner in which these animals heal. One day, it sort of blew my mind away and started me off in a direction that I've continued in.
Did the wounds get infected at all, or did they simply recover from infection?
No, they don't get infected at all, actually. It's as if you have a piece of meat closing down without any redness.
Now, if we had a wound like that, the germs, the right. Bacteria, would be normally attacked by our own immune systems. But that would look a bit different, wouldn't it?
Yes. So you imagine festering wounds. You imagine that if a similar thing happened to you, if we had deep abdominal surgery, you threw me into a pond, my wounds would fester. I would very likely die of infection. And I think that's the expected response. This was quite distinct from that.
So have you got an explanation for why this happened?
Well, we thought about it, actually, and the best explanation was that this particular animal, this frog, was actually sending out chemicals from its skin directly at the site of injury. And the reason you come to a conclusion like that is that if this animal were directing the goodies inside its body to that wound, it would be doing it through its bloodstream, if you will, and that whole area would become red and inflamed as cells from the bloodstream poured into the area. But that's not what one sees. One really sees a wound just sort of closing up and no infection. And again, the simplest hypothesis was, the simplest guess was, that a group of chemicals might actually be doing the thing.
So in a complex immune system response of the sort that humans have, there would be inflammation as white blood cells hurried to the site to engulf and destroy the invading germs. With frogs, it seems that there's a different mechanism. The animal produces specific chemicals that can target the microbes. Might these chemicals be useful in combating human disease? Michael Zasloff thought so, and he tried to work out what they might be.
We isolated those chemicals, and the chemicals turn out to be a new class of antibiotic
called,
we call them meganins. They act by piercing the membranes that surround bacteria. They are interesting to us and interesting to many people now because bacteria have not figured out a way to fight them off.
They will eventually, though, surely.
Well, we and others do not believe that that necessarily is the case. It turns out, of course, that the frog has been particularly happy with these chemicals for hundreds of millions of years. That's sort of a test, I think. But as we've come to study the problem, we've come to realize that every animal, not just the frog, from insect to mouse to cow to man, expresses, protects itself, to varying degrees with chemicals of this type.
Michael Zasloff is so optimistic about the potential healing power of meganins and their proof against antibiotic resistance that he's helped to found a company to promote the technology, Meganin Pharmaceuticals. And it's not just against bacteria that he believes they'll be useful. He thinks they can even combat cancer and viruses like HIV, although it has to be said that so far the only meganin product that's undergone clinical trials has been a foot cream for diabetics. And the company still hasn't got Food and Drug Administration approval for it. Although there doesn't seem to be much doubt that frogs and pigs can actually heal themselves, it doesn't require any change in their behaviour. It just happens naturally.
If a mammal can learn to avoid certain plant parts because they lower its fitness, it may also learn to seek out certain plant parts because they raise its fitness when searching for nutrients. This point is unquestioned, but I would like to ask if plant-eating vertebrates do it on occasion as a way of writing their own prescriptions. I've often noticed, when following solitary elephants, that when they fed extensively on a certain creeper, they invariably travelled far after such a meal. Possibly that creeper has some sustaining effect on the elephant, which acts as an incentive to greater and unusual effort. Or perhaps it acts as a painkiller when the elephant has made a decision to take a long walk.
Back in 1978, a Danish ecologist, Dan Jansen, drew together a number of anecdotal accounts of animals appearing to eat plants for medicinal purposes. He argued that if animals can learn to avoid toxic substances that are harmful, they should also be able to learn to eat things that can make them better. The idea was followed up by researchers studying primates in East Africa. Some chimps were observed to eat leaves of the Aspilia plant, which have no obvious nutritional value. Biologists at Cornell University, such as Manuel Arguin, believe that the chimps have discovered a treatment for both bacterial infection and infection by parasitic nematode worms in the Aspilia.
A chimpanzee in the field feed on it in a very peculiar way. They take leaves from this plant and they roll them in their mouth and then they swallow them whole. The field anthropologists were baffled by this type of behavior, which certainly was not typical of an animal feeding on a plant for nutritional purposes. So we postulated that possibly this plant was being fed upon for a different reason, and that was that the animals were self-medicating with it. We took Aspilia mosambicensis and brought it to the laboratory, and we prepared extracts of it, and the initial testing was done with microbes. We used a number of human pathogens, and we noted that these extracts were very active antibiotics. So that alerted us to the fact that, the chemistry in this plant was actually pharmacologically active. We sought out the active principle responsible for this antibiotic activity, and we found these sulfur-containing polyacetylenes, the thiorubrins, and found out that actually these are the very potent antibiotics. And later on, when we did evaluations, we found that they're very, very effective nematocytes.
They kill nematodes.
Kill nematodes. They can be plant pathogens or human pathogens as well.
But not everyone believes that there's anything chemical going on. Harvard anthropologist Richard Wrangham was one of the first people to observe the leaf-swallowing behaviour among chimps in Tanzania and published the observations in conjunction with the Cornell biologists. He still believes the animals are treating themselves for parasite infection, but thinks that the chimps don't chew the leaves. The effect is purely physical.
The chimps are swallowing these leaves whole. The leaves are 4 or 5 inches long, typically. And there are two ways that they could work inside the gut. One is that they could be like a scouring pad, simply sweeping through the small intestine, which tends to be held rather tight as a narrow tube until things go through it. And if there are parasites actually clinging onto the side of the small intestine, then this scouring pad effect of the bolus of leaves could just sweep anything off the sides. And one reason for saying that that might happen is that in a New World monkey, a tamarin, Paul Garber has found them swallowing seeds that distort the small intestine as they go through and again might push parasites out. But Mike Huffman thinks that something else may be going on with the little nematodes, Esophagostomum, because on a few occasions he has found that when he takes apart the leaves that have passed through the body of the chimpanzee, he finds these little worms inside the leaves. And he thinks that the significance of them being hairy, the leaves that are chosen for being swallowed, is that when they are folded together, instead of going completely flat, the leaves leave a little space because the hairs keep the two surfaces of the leaf apart. And that's like a cave. And the way that Esophagostomum nematodes stay in the body normally is to swim into the folded crevices formed by the gut wall as it bends and turns. And so in a similar way, what the nematodes might be doing is to swimming into the crevices formed by the folded leaf. And then, of course, instead of being able to stay there, they get carried out when the leaf passes out of the body.
Richard Wrangham and the Cornell biologists were initially so enthusiastic about the leaf swallowing that they coined the term zoopharmacognosy to describe the knowledge that animals have of drugs, knowledge it was thought that we could exploit for our own purposes. What's more, it would be cheap compared to exploiting the plant knowledge of indigenous human societies because you wouldn't need to pay the chimps anything. Well, maybe a few bananas. But there are some sceptics who believe that it's yet to be proven that animals have any such knowledge, and that even if a chimpanzee is observed eating plants with bioactive compounds, this doesn't amount to proof that it's medicating itself. Among the doubters is George Lozano of Simon Fraser University, British Columbia.
One of the problems of that research is that controls are seldom used. That is, if you compare any plant chimpanzees eat when they're not well against any other plant, all plants contain bioactive compounds. So the fact that you find something in that plant does not in itself mean that that plant is being consumed for therapeutic purposes. I think Sapolsky put it best when he said, we could show that potato chips contain bioactive compounds. That does not prove that we eat potato chips or any other reason, except that we like them.
Well, supposing you find a chimpanzee that is clearly ill, is clearly eating leaves of a particular plant, appears to get better afterwards, and then laboratory work shows that the extracts from those leaves appear in test tubes to kill nematodes.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that enough combined to make you think something is going on?
It is enough to make me think, well, to make me think something's going on, to convince me that something's going on, it is a different issue. That would convince me that the animal is deviating from its normal diet when it gets ill. And it may or may not happen to hit upon something that it actually helps it. And then you would have to show me that it actually remembers that. That remembers its, the fact that it got well with a certain diet, with a certain new plant, and went back to that plant the next time it got ill.
Why do you need that? Isn't it enough? If an animal is consistently doing it...
Well, if it's consistently doing it, yes. If
right.
it does it once, it's different.
So what is needed for the researchers to follow individual animals and prove consistency of behavior?
Well, I think the problem is that we don't have any known mechanisms by which this could exist or this could occur. It's a very long and complicated process. First, you have to get ill by something. Then you have to deviate from your normal diet. You start consuming a sort of different plants. And one of them possibly might help you. And at that time, you start getting well. Now, the recovery occurs several hours after you consumed the supposedly medicinal plant. And then the chimpanzee would have to remember which of the plants it was that it consumed, and it has to associate the consumption of that plant with the recovery that may occur several hours later.
The difficulty with the self-medicating hypothesis, then, is that it either relies on individual chimps chancing on effective treatments and then remembering them next time they're ill, or a group of chimpanzees collectively remembering and passing on this useful knowledge over a period of time. Either possibility requires some fairly advanced cognitive skills, and it's debatable whether they've been demonstrated beyond doubt. A further problem is that other researchers have questioned whether the thiorubrin chemicals could really work in the living animal as opposed to in a test tube, or even whether the Aspilia leaves actually contain such chemicals in the first place. But Manuel Aguillin stands by the Cornell research.
Other researchers have collected Aspilia mozambicensis in the wild looking for the thiorubrins, and they have not found them. We have consulted with them and trying to reconcile our findings with theirs, and there appears that they have not actually sampled the same populations that we initially worked with. So this could actually explain, you know, the fact that we found them and they haven't.
Overall, support for the idea that chimps have therapeutic secrets they're going to let us in on is slipping away. Indeed, some of the puzzling things that primates eat may even turn out to be stimulants. They're recreational drugs, so to speak, rather than medicines. Harvard anthropologist Richard Wrangham.
It's disappointing. We had the hope for a few years that the chimpanzees were going to sort of show us a natural pharmacopoeia, and we could have some kind of system of following chimpanzees all through Africa and being shown exciting range of drugs. But still, you've got to remember that this is based on five sites, and we've got one such species. It seems entirely reasonable to think that as the number of chimpanzee populations that are being monitored increases, other cases will turn up. It's just they're not going to turn up at as high a frequency as we once hoped, because it is pretty clear now that the leaf swallowing is only going to suggest to us that what we should do is swallow something like a kitchen sponge every now and again to get rid of our parasites. And since we don't have any parasites to speak of in the Western world, I'm not sure that's going to be much help for us.
But the new science of zoo pharmacognosy isn't quite dead in the water. There's more evidence that some African primates do seek out another plant when they're feeling ill, Vernonia, according to Andrew Whiten of St Andrews University.
Vernonia, which is found in many different parts of Africa, and in fact different chimpanzee populations do this same thing. There's even some evidence that gorillas do as well, so it's quite widespread. But they are nevertheless specific species that they have to go to. I mean, these are often plants which are attached to the banks of streams and just living singly, so the chimpanzees have to go to a very specific place to find it. And then what they do is they peel off the bark, and they don't eat the bark, they don't eat the leaves generally, unless they're really desperate, because those are actually really quite high in toxins, and they just go for the pith. And they do that, again, as in the case of eating the whole leaves, when they're ill. I mean, typically when they've got something like diarrhea, they're very lethargic. So to the scientists observing them, it's rather obvious that here is a sick chimpanzee, and it's going out of its way to go and find one of these plants and eat this specific pith. And in fact, if there are other chimpanzees around, as there sometimes are, in a normal feeding situation, they'd also be very interested in trying to eat the same thing. But in the case of this pith, if the other chimpanzees are quite well, they're just not interested at all, and it's just this one chimpanzee who is very keenly going and taking the pith.
It's a bad joke, but somebody had to make it. Some animals have been seen eating the unpalatable Vernonia pith with such grim determination that it looks as if they must believe it's doing them some good. And analysis of their feces has shown far fewer parasite worms after the treatment than before. Although this is still only anecdotal observation, laboratory analysis has backed up the self-medication theory, according to Richard Wrangham.
In the case of Vernonia, there's a team of scientists from Japan who have investigated the chemistry in considerable detail, and they can now tell you which components occur at greater strength in the pith, as a young pith as opposed to the older pith, or the pith as opposed to the leaves and seeds and so on. And there's a fair amount of work on the pharmacological activity of these compounds. And it certainly does seem as though the interest that chimpanzees and humans show in it is merited, in the sense that there is a killing effect on nematodes.
So the chimps do seem to have discovered at least one plant with medicinal properties, and even the Aspilia leaves, which failed to live up to their early promise as anti-nematode drugs, have put on a late spurt. In laboratory tests, Manuel Arguin of Cornell University has discovered that the thiorubrins extracted from these leaves appear to be effective against cancer cells.
The thyrobins, we have assessed the fact that they are highly cytotoxic. They can kill in vitro cancer cells. And in collaboration with researchers at the University of Notre Dame, we have tested chemicals, these chemicals, on solid tumors. And we have found that these chemicals actually can inhibit the growth of these tumors.
If you're interested in chimp learning and social behavior, then it's exciting to look for examples of self-taught medication. But how likely are you to discover drugs that indigenous human societies don't already know about? After all, humans are far better at sharing and recording knowledge than chimps are, and zoo pharmacognosy's one clear success, the noniapith, was already a human traditional medicine in Africa. But if you look at what animals have evolved to do rather than what they've learnt to do, maybe there's more to be discovered. Perhaps espalier leaves protect chimps against cancers without them even realising it. If the chemicals in the leaves do have this effect, then natural selection operating over millions of years would favour the chimps that eat those leaves rather than the ones that don't. George Lozano, who's sceptical about animals using drugs therapeutically, accepts that they may use them prophylactically.
Prophylactic use is the preventative use of plants. Therapeutic use occurs after an individual is already sick with a certain disease.
And why is it important to distinguish between them?
Because the behavioral mechanisms would be completely different. Because prophylactic use means that certain plants or chemicals are consumed just in case something happens. So it doesn't have to be that these plants are consumed specifically for a certain disease, but rather they could be incorporated as part of the diet. And they could be incorporated not only because of their medicinal purposes, but because of their other nutritional purposes. So the reason why these plants are being selected would be manifold. It would be proteins, nutrition, and medicinal purposes. Prophylactic use exists.
If this is correct, then the most useful research might be to study everything that animals eat, rather than the plants they seem to pick out when they're ill. In other words, animals could act as a kind of filter to narrow down which of the billions of plants in the world you subject to pharmacological analysis. Just as we don't expect frogs and Vietnamese pot-bellied pigs to know how they recover from infection and skin cancer, we wouldn't expect the primates to know which of the many plants they eat do them good, or why. Unconscious evolution would have done the hard work, and we wouldn't be tapping into expert knowledge, but expert instinct.